coming up next is Dr. Aoife O'Donoghue. She's a senior lecturer at Durham Law School, and she's going to be telling us all about a project they've been working on over there for a number of months now. It's called the Northern Irish Feminists Judgment Project. It's a bit of a mouthful, but if you listen, Aoife explains very well what the project is all about. Aoife, of course, was recently involved in our Women in 1916 series that we recorded over in Coolock Library over the last 3 weeks, and the programme she was involved in will be going out this Wednesday afternoon at 2:30 p.m. So really interesting as well, if you want to listen into that at 2:30 here on Near FM this Wednesday. But we're going to go over now to Aoife and have a listen to what she had to tell us. Joining me on the line now is Dr. Aoife O'Donoghue from the Durham Law School. Hello, Aoife. Thank you for joining us on Near FM.
Hello, Mark. Lovely to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you as well, Aoife. Aoife, you're involved in a project at Durham Law School called the Northern Irish Feminist Judgments Project. Could you tell us firstly what the project is all about?
Well, it's a project covering the whole island, so Northern Ireland and the Republic. And in the project, we're rewriting judgments, some of them really famous cases that were covered in newspapers, and then other not so famous cases. So we look at them, and the project basically asks us to see, could they have been decided differently if you took a feminist perspective? So if you took it from a woman's perspective, would you have decided the case differently? So we don't change the law, we don't change the facts. We're very strict on that. You have to follow the law. But it asks, were there other outcomes that could have happened? Could it have been different? And then would that have changed the lives of women on the island? For the better, we'd hope. But it's to kind of show that the law and the judges, that it's not inevitable what happens in the law, what happens in the courts, that there are choices that can be made, and that perhaps better choices could have been made for Irish women going back since independence.
Okay, it's an interesting concept. What was the thinking behind it? As you say, look at the law and see that we don't all view it the same way. What I'm trying to get at is that straight away you could imagine people going, here go these feminists again, and men can't do anything right. I know you're keen to probably make sure that people don't understand it that way. It's just to look at the laws and the judgments in a broader scale. Is that what it's about?
It pretty much is. So the first time this was done was in Canada, and then it was done again in England. There was a project in England, and it really is to demonstrate, because really cases particularly are all about the arguments that are presented to the court. So it's all about what one barrister says and then what the other barrister says, and which one of the two of them the barrister or the judge believes. And of course, nobody, all those barristers and all the judges, they're all people like everybody else. They all grew up in a particular way, and they all went to school in particular schools, and they all have different family relationships and vote for different political parties. So everybody comes to making legal arguments or being a judge from whoever they are themselves. And really, in the law up to now has been dominated really not just by men, but by very conservative ideas about what the law should or shouldn't do and what women should or shouldn't do. So it's not just simply about, it's always been men and it should be women, but that it's a very particular interpretation about what the law should do. And really in the project, what we're saying is that another political perspective, so from our perspective, a feminist perspective, mm-hmm. but you could equally do a communist one, say, if you wanted to do one, or a capitalist one, or a socialist one, if you wanted to do that, that you could present alternative arguments. Because I think people think that the judges and that lawyers, that the law is kind of certain, and particularly something like the Constitution, that there's only ever going to be one answer. Yeah. Kind of in the project, we're suggesting there are others. Now, not all the cases come to a different decision than the court. So often, actually, in the judgments, we come to the same decision that the court did. Because, of course, the law doesn't change. But what we do is perhaps we tell the story a little differently.
Yeah.
So We might give somebody a name. Very often the courts will call somebody by their surname only. Or we're here, we might give them their full name and we might tell their story a little differently. So if you think about something like rape, there's a lot of rape myths, you know, that you don't know mm-hmm. who the perpetrator is, or that women are drunk, or that they're dressed in a particular way. Or we would, in the case, you would tell the story of the woman and what happened that night and not kind of go along with those myths. So it's not necessarily suggesting that, you know, the law should be different or that the case would be decided differently, but just perhaps telling the story differently or bringing in other facts or other arguments that were left out that you could prove.
A matter of perspective, basically. You know, different people with different life experience and different backgrounds will bring different perspectives to the same subject, regardless of what it is. And as you say, in this case, it's the law.
Yeah, exactly it. So it is, and it's saying that, you know, and hopefully what we're trying to do is, in the longer term, is talk to law students and barristers and even school students and say, you know, this is how the law works, and that it's not neutral, that there is always a political perspective in the law that's being brought there, or a social perspective. And that when we recognise that, it allows us to understand how a decision was made, but also to maybe think of other arguments that can be presented, other legal arguments that can be presented to the court, and perhaps change things in the longer term to make women's lives in Ireland perhaps a little better understanding of what it actually means to be a woman. So if you only have men, a group of men, which up to very recently it would have been, trying to understand what it would be like to be a mother, or to be a daughter, or to be paid less for the same work that you're doing, just having a female voice there might help in the understanding of what's happening. It might lead to the same conclusion, but it might lead to a better understanding of that.
Yeah, and there's an interesting connection as well, because in your research, if I'm correct, you know, you've gone back a long way, and I mean, we're celebrating, of course, as we know, the centenary of 1916 rising here next weekend. And have you gone back that far into the roles of women and the roles of women coming out of those struggles as well in your research? And what kind of conclusions has it led you to?
Well, absolutely. Not the cases themselves, actually. Mm-hmm. Our earliest case dates from the early 1970s, actually. But in looking at the legal profession and the law and how the law shaped women's lives, we've gone right back, because we're covering both jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. And that was very important to us, because we wanted to kind of go back to 1916 and 1922 and look at what happened when two new jurisdictions came about. And what were the different stories of women's lives that were told in both? So it was really important to us that we understand what it was like to be a woman in Ireland before the division and partition into two islands. And it was a really interesting period for women, in that there had been a lot of reform. There was, of course, the suffragette movement that was going on. There was reform around property law. So women were starting to get control over property, and women were starting to become legal professionals. So they were starting to graduate with law degrees, were starting to become solicitors and barristers, were being allowed to serve on juries for the first time. So around this period, there were a lot of significant legal changes. But also, as part of the movement to independence, a lot of the women that were involved, some of the famous women like Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, were involved in the Doyle courts. So the courts that ran, the Sinn Féin courts before them, that ran right up and into independence. And a lot of them acted as judges then. Mm-hmm. So there were women actively involved who wanted women's lives to be better in the new state that was to be created, and to be actively involved in the law. But what happened after independence is kind of that all of that went into reverse. So women were still getting law degrees, but they were very slow in moving into the professions mm-hmm. and practicing. So there wasn't until the 60s that you get the first female judge again, having had lots of female judges in the Doyle courts. You also, of course, get the the introduction of the 1922 Constitution, which does give every woman the vote, but doesn't have the equality provision that, for instance, the 1916 Declaration of Independence does, where it starts from the very beginning talking to both men and women in Ireland. That's lost in the 1922 Constitution. Mm. And of course, the 1937 Constitution was very aggressive for women. And women protested quite vigorously at the time of the 1937 Constitution. And from women were also removed from the juries in Ireland in the 1920s and didn't return to jury duty in Ireland until the late 1970s. So you have a period around 1916 where women are gaining lots of ground. They're making lots of legal reform and success, and it's really exciting. And you can see in the writing of the time that women are looking forward to what their lives will be like in the new state, where they think they'll have a lot more freedom. But unfortunately, that's not what happened. They were left down in lots of ways, particularly the women who were so proactive in the movement. They were in lots of ways, and there are many reasons for that. Part of which was a lot of them were on the anti-treaty side, so were sidelined from that perspective. But also when Fianna Fáil and the anti-treaty side did finally get into government, De Valera was never on side with women's rights and women's votes. Even in 1916, for instance, he was the only commander in 1916 who wouldn't leave any women on site.
Yeah.
So there was very little hope that De Valera was going to, even for the women who were on the anti-treaty side, that he would sort of turn things around for women. So there was a lot of hope in 1916 that a lot of women had, but unfortunately that didn't really start to play out until the 1980s and 1990s. Though all through this period you have very active women who are doing very positive things and are activists and developing as far as they can within the legal structure the role of women within Irish society.
Yeah, so in when it came to the formation of the state, the Free State, or then onto the Republic, women's voices in with regards to law and courts and everything else were very much in the background and not heard at all. What your project here is doing is maybe giving people the idea that, well, you know, if we'd have had a different perspective, a female perspective, a feminist perspective, maybe some of the laws and some of the judgments even way back then may have been different and may well have been for the betterment of everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. For the whole of society, really. Because, I mean, when you talk about issues around contraception or divorce or marital rape, for example, I mean, these are issues that affect everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, affect children, adults, older people, younger people, men and women. And some of the cases that we do aren't, you know, they're not the obvious cases. I mean obviously things that are more directly engaged with women, but we cover cases with regard to school children, for instance, and we do cases to guard the Anglo-Irish Agreement and how the McGimsey case, which divides Northern Ireland into two communities, all of whom are represented by men. And in that, you're further excluding women, and you're excluding people who don't want to identify as being either unionist or nationalist, who perhaps don't want to be in either of those groups, or perhaps if they were gay, they wouldn't have been accepted all that readily into either of those groups in the 1970s and 80s particularly. So it's about how the sort of dominance of one, not only men, but a very conservative idea meant that you excluded a lot more groups, and that taking this perspective and adding women into the mix might have led to change. Of course, there's no way we can test that for definite.
Yeah.
And there's no way of knowing that certainly would have been the case. Yeah. But I think from doing the project, I think we've all come to understand that the missed opportunities we had back in 1922 and 37, and in Northern Ireland the same. I mean, Northern Ireland only this year has its first female senior judges. There were no women in the upper courts in Northern Ireland until 2016, and that's a very sad indication, because women were equally active in the nationalist and unionist side in Northern Ireland in 1916 and 1922. So it's an equally sad story up there,
yeah,
which I think did affect all of society. it affected everybody, I think, to negatively. And it's I think we have a great opportunity now, because we're on the anniversary and we're coming up to the anniversary of partition, to think about what could have been different, not just for women, but for, I think, society more generally. What other choices could Ireland have made? And maybe some of the choices that we made that were very positive. You know, there were good things that happened as well. Of course, it's not all a negative story. But
indeed, and you know, as you say, you mentioned the Majimsey case there, and a couple of others. I think it was three that you selected for the project. Is that correct, or did you just select more than that?
Oh, there's over 16 cases involved. Oh, in the project.
Okay.
We had over 100 people involved altogether. So that we were a real mix of some academics, obviously, but also activists who were involved in various projects in both sides of the border. We had quite a lot of artists involved who were tremendous for lawyers, because it allowed us to see things that we mightn't have seen, you know, bringing to our attention.
Yeah.
Things, because for lawyers, we tend to think of the world in a very particular way. Mm-hmm. So we had some great artists, Sarah Brown and Jesse Presley, but also some great poets like Sarah Clancy and William Wall involved. And they were able to kind of bring a different perspective. So and it's an ongoing project at the moment, but we have well over 100 people involved. So the actual cases we had, we've about 16 cases actually involved in the project itself, covering a huge range. So everything from children to contraception to tort claims, so kind of claims, you know, private claims between two parties.
Yeah.
We've got contract law cases. We've got mortgage cases. So we've cases covering sort of all elements of life, if you might say, all ways in which the law kind of interacts with your life. So there's a huge range of cases.
Yeah.
But too many to cover, I think.
I imagine. And would it ultimately be the case then that, you know, as you say, you go forward with this project and you're revisiting cases and stuff like that, do you think it will ultimately lead to change within the profession itself? People will look at maybe how they select judges and stuff like that going forward?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what we would hope. So we've started running already some courses with practitioners, so barristers and solicitors, to talk to them about the types of arguments they present and showing them the judgments and showing them the alternative legal arguments, and working with law students as well and secondary school students to do the same. Because when you're taught law, very often you're presented with a judgment and you kind of think this is the gold standard, you know, this is the best that there could be. Whereas sort of to show them there are other ways of doing it. And the long-term aim is that it will affect the arguments that are brought to the court, how we think about the constitution or legislation, but also what we think of when we think of a judge.
Yeah.
I mean, what most people's vision when they think of a judge is that they think of a white, middle-class, older man. Is generally what people think of, probably with a particular accent. To sort of challenge that, you know, that it could be a working class voice that you hear, or a woman's voice you hear, or a black person or an Asian person, that it's not inevitable that that it's one kind of judge, that they actually do and should come from lots of different backgrounds. I mean, the Irish Supreme Court always had one Protestant on it, and that was their idea of diversity, was to have one Protestant. But it's sort of the idea that diversity must go beyond that. It must go to the... Of course, people have to be qualified in all those elements, because very often people will say, well, it should be merit.
Yeah.
But what's become clear, and a lot of research has gone into it, is that when we think of somebody and we think of them as being a particular type of person, we're going to see the merit there, because that's where we expect to see it. So we expect that, you know, the white middle class man will make the good judge, because that's who've made the judges up to now. So it's about challenging our perceptions and challenging who we think is good at the law and not good at the law. So that's what we'd hope the project has in the longer term, the type of impact that we would love to have, is to, you know, and beyond the actual immediate lawyers, to kind of everybody sort of, you know, who thinks about it. And when you go go to court or you interact with courts or with solicitors or barristers or even politicians who make the law, that we think, well, why is it that way? Is it inevitable that it's that way? Or are there other ways that we could think about the law or think about the people who make the law or enforce the law?
Well, I suppose, you know, as we move in towards the middle of the 21st century, we're very much becoming a more multicultural society all around the world. And I suppose we need to bring that multiculturalism and that inclusion into our lawmaking and into our judiciary and into our courts in order to be able to, A, be more robust, and B, ensure that we are actually judging cases and using the law correctly and efficiently.
Yeah, and for it to be representative. I mean, mm-hmm. sometimes I think we forget that courts are part of government, mm-hmm. they're part of how we run the state. And, you know, that in order for them to be robust, in order for them to do those cases, they have to be representative of the people who live in the country. And if they're not representative of the people who live in the country, then there's a problem if they only represent a small section. Because if you're appearing before the court and you don't see anybody like you, you're not going to have as much confidence. And you need to have confidence that they will understand you and understand your story.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important that, you know, alongside the robustness and the doing the law correctly, is that the courts are representative, because they serve everybody. They are for everybody to maybe sometimes enforce the law against us, but also to protect us, to protect our constitutional rights, to protect us from government or the state, or to protect us from other people that we encounter in our lives. So it is important that we see it as serving us and therefore also looking like us.
Absolutely. It's been fabulous talking to you, and it's a fascinating subject. I was doing a bit of reading on some of the information you sent me last night. And just on that, if people are listening in and they're kind of intrigued by what they're hearing, is there a website they can go where they can listen or they can read up on some of the test cases that you did and read up on some of the findings that you have so far?
Absolutely. It's www.feministjudging.ie. So if you look up that site, so www.feministjudging.ie, mm-hmm. You'll also find us on Facebook. So you can like us on Facebook. If you put Northern/Irish Feminist Judgments Project into Facebook, you can find us there. And we're also on Twitter at IrishFJP. And you'll find links to all the information there that we have, and our email address if somebody wanted to get directly in contact with us and ask us any questions. We're happy to go. But there's myself and I've two other colleagues, Julie McCandless, the LSC, and Marie Denwright at Kent Law School, who are involved in co-directing the project. So we'd be very happy to be in contact with anybody who'd like to discuss issues in the project with us.
Well, Aoife, it's, as I say, it's absolutely fascinating, and thanks so much for taking the time out today to talk to us on Near FM. And sure, we look forward to maybe talking to you again in the future, because this going forward, well, imagine I'm kind of imagining that, you know, as this project goes forward, there may be a time where I don't know how it works with the law, but there may be a time where working, there might be something is happening and it's kind of up to date, and you may be kind of running parallel with it. I don't know, where legally you probably can't do that, but it'd be interesting to see, because, you know, something controversial always comes up in the courts, and maybe it'd be interesting to.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, we're for instance, we've rewritten the X case, so we've had several cases in the last few years, mm-hmm. with regard to abortion and interpreting the constitution. So that's sort of the kind of up to date things that are happening at the moment that the project is very relevant to. And how, you know, the Eighth Amendment has worked and been interpreted. So absolutely, as the law evolves and changes and government decides to do things or the courts make a decision, definitely I think the project will run kind of alongside those kind of changes, hopefully, anyway.
Yeah. Okay, Dr. Aoife O'Donoghue from Durham Law School, Law College, is it a law school? I'm getting that wrong. Law school, I do apologise. Great, yeah. Thank you for talking to us on Near FM, and we look forward to talking to you again. Take care, all the best, bye-bye.
And thank you, Mark.
There you go, folks. That was Dr. Aoife O'Donoghue from Durham Law School telling us all about their Northern Irish Women in Judgments project. Hugely fascinating stuff. Feminist Judgments project, I beg your pardon. Hugely interesting stuff, and makes for great reading if you're interested in that sort of thing. Go onto the website www.feministjudgments.ie.